Chapter 3. Foot Soldiers of Foreign Policy. The next morning, July 31, 1975, as I attempted to hurry through the East Asia Division processing to get myself assigned back to Africa Division and to collect $2,000 I was due for out-of-pocket travel expenses, a young woman stuck her head around a partition. "If you are John Stockwell, you'd better come to the phone," she said. George Costello was on the line, in one of his surly moods. "Where are you, and what the hell are you doing?" "I'm in the EA finance office getting checked in. Didn't Carl—" "You don't seem to understand." His voice was loud. I held the receiver away from my ear. "You're needed in Africa Division now. Screw EA. Potts has immediate cables on his desk that should have been answered already. I want you back in my office now." It was Costello at his lovable best. I hurried out, not smiling, as I thought of my $2,000. I needed that money. Taking the stairs from the fifth floor, I hurried down C Corridor and braced myself as I ducked into Costello's office. He didn't look any friendlier than he had sounded. "Why weren't you in staff meeting?" he snarled. "Didn't Carl—" "No, Carl didn't anything." Costello calmed himself with a visible effort and waved some cables at me. Things were happening, a lot of things. Potts was tied up for the morning, assisting the director in briefing the Office of Management and Budget to get the $14 million released. People were traveling. Air transports were in flight. Costello handed me the cables, and I took hasty notes, writing across their tops as he explained them. The first C-141 flight of arms had gone out 2 days before. Two more C-141 flights were being put together on a high-priority basis, the arms coming from agency warehouses in Texas, and the loads assembled in South Carolina. One plane would leave Sunday, August 3rd. The agency's Office of Logistics would handle most of the stateside coordination. Africa Division, with the help of SOG Air Force Liaison and the Office of Logistics, had to plan the operation, hammer out the composition of the load, and send a formal memorandum to the Pentagon requesting the airplane. Cables had to be exchanged with Monrovia Station in Liberia, where the aircraft would refuel at Robertsfield, and with Kinshasa, where the cargo would be offloaded at night. The Kinshasa CIA station had its own problems: getting clearances for the flight while keeping it secret, procuring 30,000 pounds of fuel for the plane's return, and arranging for Zairean army trucks to meet the plane precisely on time. The CIA maintains prepackaged stocks of foreign weapons for instant shipment anywhere in the world. The transportation is normally provided by the U.S. Air Force, or by private charter if the American presence must be masked. Even tighter security can be obtained by contracting with international dealers who will purchase arms in Europe and subcontract independently to have them flown into the target area. Often the CIA will deliver obsolete American weapons, arguing that World War II left so many scattered around the world they are no longer attributable to the U.S. In the Angolan program, we obtain such obsolete weapons from the National Guard and U.S. Army Reserve stores. Initially, U.S. Air Force C-130 transports picked up weapons from the CIA warehouse in San Antonio, Texas, and delivered them to Charleston, South Carolina. U.S. Air Force C-141 jet transports then hauled 25-ton loads across the Atlantic to Kinshasa. Inevitably, the Air Force billed the CIA for the service, $80,000 for each flight. Our C-141 flights were masked by regular U.S. Air Force military air charter planes, which routinely delivered supplies to the U.S. Army mission in Kinshasa and arms to the Zairean Army. A U.S. Air Force plane offloading weapons in Kinshasa attracts little attention. Repeatedly during the program, we would place a token amount of certain weapons, such as the M-72 light anti-tank rocket, LAWS, or the M-79 grenade launcher, on an overt military air charter flight in the name of the Defense Department for delivery to the Zairean Army, to lay a paper trail which would explain to auditors and to prying eyes the existence of these weapons in Zaire and Angola. A shipload of arms was being assembled at Charleston, South Carolina, to be hauled to Zaire in a U.S. Navy transport vessel, the American Champion. The Chief of Station Lusaka was requesting permission to meet with the UNITA leader, Jonas Savimbi, in Lusaka. Heretofore, we had monitored UNITA through meetings with its other officers. This meeting was to be encouraged. Kinshasa Station was pleading for airplanes to fly military supplies to the FNLA and UNITA bases inside Angola. There was no easy answer to this one. In fact, we would search the world for months for a C-130 or even several DC-3s which could support the Angola program, and never find any. Two Zairean Air Force C-130 airplanes were being overhauled in Marietta, Georgia, by Lockheed International. Kinshasa Station was urging us to expedite their completion, and if necessary, to foot the $600,000 bill to get them back in action. The government of Zaire itself was broke, out of credit, and unable to pay. Six other immediate cables required answers. One concerned the disappearance of a European journalist on the agency payroll, whom the Brussels station had sent to Luanda. Luanda's station was requesting permission to have another agent attempt to find her, although this would reveal her CIA affiliation to that agent. A freelance photographer headquarters had sent to Luanda to photograph Russian arms was being indiscreet and arguing with the case officer about his allowances, claiming he couldn't survive on $130 per diem. I drafted a cable ordering the station to send the man home, only to learn the hard way that he was a friend of George Costello. Costello had arranged his contract and was determined to keep him in Luanda at all costs. I was getting an idea of what life would be like running the Angolan task force. As for the physical space for the task force, the desks, telephones, typewriters, safes, and the people to man it, Costello had told me to see the chief of support. But as I left Costello's office, he fired a parting shot. "Don't spend a lot of time worrying about desks and people. Just keep writing answers to those cables." I scarcely knew the chief of support, who had been brought to the division by Potts while I was in Vietnam. He was a sallow chap, it turned out, a GS-15 bucking for promotion in a GS-16 job. He had spent most of his career in the Middle East, where Potts had known him for many years. "They're not ready yet," he snapped, when I asked where my offices were to be. "We're working on it. Don't worry about it. You're going to have a beautiful vault, but it'll take a few days. These things take time." His voice became belligerent. "You just got back from a long leave, so don't start bitching at me about your office space already." He had a fat man's wheeze compounded by the large cigar he was trying to chew while he yelled. "No problem, but I've got to have a place to sit now." I held up the cables. "You go over to Horn and Central. They've got lots of room. They'll find a place for you." Horn and Central was the branch which handled Central Africa, including Angola. But Horn and Central knew how to play the space game. They tried to send me back to the chief of support, and when I balked, I was waved vaguely toward the outer fringes of the branch. They were overcrowded, the Horn and Central chief said, but maybe someone was on leave or something. I stood in the middle of the Horn and Central offices with the cables in my hand and reflected. No one was on leave. Secretaries shouldn't be displaced because of their typewriters and supplies. Reports officers tended to be surrounded by their own special files and also were nearly always overworked. In a corner was an officer I had once replaced overseas years ago. He had never been overworked a day in his life that I knew of, but he was a section chief. Behind the next partition was a young officer who appeared to be reading a file, probably a career trainee on interim assignment. He would be the equivalent of a second lieutenant. I was a colonel. I closed in on him, introduced myself, explained my problem, and asked if he would be so kind as to loan me his desk for a couple of days. He leaped up and insisted it was no inconvenience at all. I slid into his chair. A few moments later, Marvin, the deputy branch chief, loomed over the desk. We were the same grade and friendly, but I was encroaching on his territory. "John," he said, "we're trying to get you some working space. Now, I know you've got problems, but it would be better if we could solve them without disrupting other officers. I had Gregory working on something important." I stood ready to insist, but a secretary hailed me with a phone call from the front office, and I had to hurry off to see Carl Bantam. By the time I returned, Gregory was reinstalled at his desk, with my cables neatly placed on the corner. He didn't look up as I gathered them and turned away. Carl had given me two more cables to answer and a memo to write, all immediate. Something had to give. My eyes focused on the floor just outside of the branch chief's offices, at the point that would bear the heaviest traffic in Horn and Central. I walked over, took off my shoes, and settled into a variation of the yoga Siddhasana, making four stacks of cables, and began to write on a yellow pad on my knee. Feet approached, hesitated, then turned towards the other door, the long way around. I ignored everything, concentrating. Marvin came to his door, turned, and went back inside his office. The branch chief himself came hurrying from his office and narrowly missed stepping on the Lusaka cables. "You walk across my desk, and I'll break your bloody leg," I said. Then I glanced up. "Oh, hi. I didn't realize it was you. Nobody's on vacation here at Horn and Central." His feet disappeared into Marvin's office. Leaving my work stacked on the floor, I got up and hurried down the hall, responding to another summons from the front office. When I got back almost an hour later, Marvin directed me to a desk by the window, on which my papers were already stacked. A desk by the window is one of the first small perquisites which come with mounting responsibility in the agency. Interim career trainees normally sit in the passageways along with the secretaries. Section chiefs usually have windows and get to park in the south parking lot. Deputy branch chiefs rate individual offices. Branch chiefs add carpets and drapes. And division chiefs have large stuffed leather chairs and a sofa and park in reserved slots near the main entrance. It was good to have a desk, but right then I needed something else even more. Information. There was no way I could go on answering these cables when I didn't know the players. Who was N.I. Fizzle 1? I.A. Moldy 1? G.P. Swish? It would take hours for me to dig answers out of the files once I learned where the files were. Clearly, there would be no time for reading in today. The most effective shortcut would be the desk officer, if she was any good. I turned into the Angola office of Horn and Central, where the desk officer, Brenda McElhenney, was laying out her lunch of French fries and a hamburger. Brenda McElhenney was very good. She produced confident, detailed answers to every question I could think to ask. McElhenney had been on the Angola desk for a year, and had recently returned from Angola, where she had reopened the Luanda station. She was typical of a number of CIA women. She had come into the agency 8 years before with a solid academic background from the University of Arizona. Although she had had no problem getting into the Deputy Directorate of Operations, she wasn't given any encouragement for a field assignment, and was instead stuck in one of the headquarters staffs, where her abilities were temporarily stymied. After 2 years of this, she took leave without pay from the agency to resume work on her doctorate. She came back on board in the hopes that she would be given a real chance in operations, in Africa Division. However, her efforts to get an overseas assignment were again frustrated. She was told candidly by the division chief that there were already too many women case officers in Africa Division, none of them remarkably effective. Not even the Equal Employment Office could help her get an assignment which would have been routine for a male with comparable qualifications. She eventually abandoned the fight, rationalizing that even if it meant she was already plateaued at the GS-12 level with little chance of advancement, she had no better offers outside the agency, and she could not afford to go back to school. The mission to Luanda had been a sop to appease her anger, and perhaps it had worked. She seemed cheerful as well as knowledgeable as she answered my questions. And, as I said, she was good. "G.P. Swish?" Her laughter could be heard all over the branch. "That's Tom Killoran, the Consul General in Luanda. A dear man, but he doesn't have much use for the CIA. Brenda and I both knew that State Department principal officers often view their parasitic CIA stations as unnecessary liabilities. Generally, the CIA station chief is the second or third secretary of the embassy, but he always has considerably more free funds to spend than the ambassador and all of the legitimate State Department officers together. For example, as COS in Bujumbura, I had $900 per year in representational funds, plus an unlimited amount of operational entertainment funds, plus a virtually unlimited fund for agents' salaries, bribes, and gifts. Altogether, I had about $30,000 cash each year to dole out or spend to enhance my effectiveness. The ambassador and three foreign service officers had a total of $2,000 between them, not enough to cover the 4th of July reception. The extra money translates into greater social and operational activity, making the CIA man more visible and seemingly more important than the State Department officers. Often the CIA man will even establish a direct contact with the chief of state, leading him to believe that, through the CIA, he has the more authentic contact with the American government. At the same time, while the CIA station rarely produces significantly better or more timely intelligence than the embassy obtains through overt sources, it always represents a liability to the United States Embassy as CIA officers scurry about with their semi-covert operations, bribing and corrupting local officials. Since the Kennedy administration, the State Department Chief of Mission, the Ambassador, Consul General, or Chargé d'Affaires, is the President's official representative in a given country, and all other agencies are subordinate to him. A strongly anti-agency ambassador can make problems for the CIA chief of station, although any effort to evict a CIA station altogether is impossibly restricted by politics and bureaucratic inertia back in Washington. McElhinney predicted that G.P. Swish would be greatly exasperated when he learned about the IA feature program. Swish, so far, had not been briefed, not even told of the 40 Committee's decision of January 1975 to fund the FNLA. He believed the MPLA was best qualified to run Angola, and that its leaders sincerely wanted a peaceful relationship with the United States. Swish had worked with all three movements, and found the MPLA better organized and easier for him to see. They were the best educated up and down the line, from leaders who had taken doctorates at European universities to cadres of urban dwellers, civil servants, and technicians. By comparison, the FNLA, Holden Roberto's crowd, had few educated men at the top, no intellectuals, and had spent much of its history in the cocktail parties of Kinshasa. The FNLA soldiers had been slathering animals when they came into Luanda that spring, 1975. UNITA was about the same, except for Savimbi, who was a good man by any standard. Scoffing at my notion that MPLA leaders were hostile to the United States, McElhinney went on. It was only the CIA's historic relationship with Roberto that had us so close to the FNLA, and even he, despite many years of association, wouldn't tell us much. For example, the Chinese had publicly announced their FNLA advisor program, and we knew they were at Kinkuza, Zaire, but Roberto wouldn't talk to the CIA about them. We knew even less about Savimbi. Our alliance with him was based solely on his opposition to the MPLA. The MPLA was rooted in the Umbundu tribe, which the Portuguese had overwhelmed in the 16th century. The Portuguese had, quote, transformed the Umbundu homeland in central Angola into what has been called the first black African nation to be subjected to European rule, unquote. Footnote. Markham, The Angolan Revolution, Volume 1. End footnote. Umbundu resistance erupted periodically during the next 350 years. In 1907 to 1910, an Umbundu leader, Kazwangango, organized attacks on the railroads and fought a pre-nationalist guerrilla war from the Dembos Hills. Geographic location gave the Umbundu greater access to the Portuguese in central Angola, and they became the domestic servants, the assistants, the black semi-skilled labor force living in the Mukekes slums of Luanda. A handful managed to obtain advanced educations by pursuing the politically safe fields of clergy and medicine. As they studied and traveled in Europe, they found that Marxist philosophy alone seemed to offer an alternative to Portuguese oppression. In addition to moral support, Marxism gave them organizational skills to develop a revolutionary movement. Capitalism, as espoused by the United States, firmly supported the Portuguese. Catholicism supported the Portuguese. American Protestant missionaries were at odds with the Portuguese, but in the end taught passive submission. The modern Umbundu leaders became Marxists and organized a nationalist political movement, which they eventually called the Popular Movement, the MPLA. Their hostility to the Portuguese spilled over into criticism of the arch-imperialists, the United States. The premier MPLA leader, Agostinho Neto, was born September 17, 1922, and grew up in contact with Methodist missionaries in Luanda. He was one of the few blacks to complete the Liceu Salvador Correa, the secondary school in Luanda. In 1947, supported by a Methodist scholarship, he went to study medicine at the University of Lisbon and Coimbra. His poems, political views, and active participation in opposition politics had him in and out of Portuguese jails from 1952 to 1958. He received his medical doctorate in 1958 and returned to practice medicine in Luanda. On June 8, 1960, he was once again arrested, flogged in front of his family, and taken off to jail. His intellectual ability, personal martyrdom, and prison credentials ensured his status as leader of the popular movement. CIA briefing sheets, reflecting Portuguese and FNLA biases, implied that Neto was a drunken psychotic poet. Two of Neto's poems follow. Western Civilization. Tin sheets nailed to poles fixed in the earth make a house. Rags complete the landscape. The sun penetrating cracks awakes each occupant. Afterwards, 12 hours of slaving work. Break stone, cart stone. Break stone, cart stone. In the sun, in the rain. Break stone, cart stone. Old age comes early. A coarse mat in the dark night suffices to die, grateful and hungry. Realization. Fear in the air. On each street corner, vigilant sentries light incendiary glances in each house. Hasty replacement of the old bolts of the doors. In each conscience, seize the fear of listening to itself. History is to be told anew. Fear in the air. It happens that I, humble man, still more humble in my black skin, come back to Africa, to myself, with dry eyes. Footnote. Dr. Agostino Neto, translated into English by Aaron Siegel, printed with permission from Markham, The Angolan Revolution. End footnote. Arguing with McElhinney, I took up Kissinger's simplistic line that the Soviets had to be confronted anywhere they made a move, this time in Angola. Do we just stand back and let them have a free rein with the Third World? You are suffering from a bad case of party line, McElhinney informed me archly. The Soviets did not make the first move in Angola. Other people did. The Chinese and the United States. The Soviets have been a half step behind, countering our moves. And don't put all the blame on Kissinger. The CIA led the United States into the Angolan mess, she added. The Portuguese coup was April 25, 1974. But in 1973, Roberto had already begun accepting arms from the Chinese. On May 29, 1974, the first contingent of 112 Chinese military advisors, led by a major general of the Chinese army, arrived in Zaire to train the FNLA forces. The Chinese issued a press release announcing the arrival of these advisors. In July 1974, the CIA began funding Roberto without 40 committee approval. Small amounts at first, but enough for word to get around that the CIA was dealing itself into the race. In August, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union announced that it considered the MPLA to be the true spokesman of the Angolan people. The Soviets began flying arms to Dar es Salaam, designated for African Liberation Movements. The CIA could only speculate whether they were for Rhodesian and South African movements or the MPLA on the other side of the continent. On August 28th, the Kinshasa press announced that the Romanian Communist Party had presented a large quantity of military equipment to the FNLA. On September 10th, the FNLA publicly acknowledged the receipt of 450 tons of supplies from China. During the fall of 1974, the CIA continued to fund Roberto, still without 40 committee approval, and its intelligence reporting on Angola was predominantly from Zairean and FNLA sources. Most important, McElhinney emphasized, the flagrant, semi-overt activities of the CIA station in Kinshasa ensured that American support of the FNLA would be widely known. There was reporting that the Soviet Union began filtering limited amounts of arms to the MPLA late in 1974. In the Alvor Agreement, January 15, 1975, the three movements agreed to compete peacefully for elections to be held in October 1975. Every indication was that UNITA and the MPLA acted in good faith, although no one could deny the likelihood of violence if one party threatened to dominate the elections. On January 22, 1975, the 40 Committee authorized the CIA to pass $300,000 to the FNLA, which was historically the most warlike of the movements and which was thought to have the largest army, in February 1975, encouraged by Mobutu and the United States, Roberto moved his well-armed forces into Angola and began attacking the MPLA in Luanda and northern Angola. In one instance, in early March, they gunned down 50 unarmed MPLA activists. The fate of Angola was then sealed in blood. The issue could only be decided through violence. Footnote. Note that the original 40 Committee Options paper acknowledged the United States' vulnerability to charges of escalating the Angola conflict when it stated that a leak by an American official source would be serious, that we would be charged with responsibility for the spread of civil war in Angola. End footnote. Again, the CIA support of the FNLA was known in Luanda and in Kinshasa, where the Soviets and Cubans maintained active embassies. Although allied with the MPLA through the early 70s, the Soviets had shut off their support in 1973. Only in March 1975 did the Soviet Union begin significant arms shipments to the MPLA. Then, in response to the Chinese and American programs and the FNLA's successes, it launched a massive airlift. Its AN-12 and the giant AN-22 airplanes carried their loads to the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville, where short-haul air transports and small ships filtered the weapons to MPLA units near Luanda. The Portuguese, although officially neutral, tended to favor the MPLA and did not inhibit their access to Soviet arms. The fighting in Luanda intensified in July. With about equal force of arms, the MPLA had the significant advantage of defending the Mbundu tribal homelands. It prevailed and evicted the FNLA and UNITA from Luanda. McElhinney was convinced that the CIA Angola program was a mistake, which would damage and discredit the United States. We were confronting the Soviets over a country that was of little importance to either of us, at a time when the United States' internal politics and public sensitivities would prevent us from following through if the conflict escalated. The Chinese and Soviets had each made public announcements of their support of Angolan factions. The United States, under Kissinger's leadership, was publicly committed to an embargo against the delivery of arms to Angolan factions while it was secretly launching a paramilitary program. Such a program was self-limiting, too small to win. It was at the same time too large to be kept secret. "Okay, okay," I said, "but what then do we do in Angola? What is our best line?" Far better would be a policy of non-involvement. Sincerely condemn outside interference and prevail on all parties, including the Soviet Union and the Chinese, to work for a peaceful solution. President Senghor of Senegal had just called for United Nations initiatives to halt the fighting. We could respond. And we could establish fair ties with all three movements and welcome the eventual winner into the family of nations. Later, I took McElhinney's arguments to Carl Bantam, unfortunately catching him in a sour mood. He brushed them aside, brusquely pointing out that we CIA case officers were the foot soldiers of foreign policy, professionals, paid for our special action capabilities. It was not our role to analyze policy, only to implement it. And how was I coming on the memorandum about the airplane? There was no time for reflection. Cables kept arriving faster than I could respond to them, and the front office maintained its clamoring pressure. By 9 p.m., I was wrung out. Nearly everyone was gone. A lone typewriter clattered far down the hall. An occasional phone rang. I sat for a while, appreciating the quiet. Carl had gone to a dinner with friends, leaving me a key to his place. All of the cables that I could respond to were on their way. No more immediate cables could come to Africa Division because registry was closed. Those marked NI Act for night action would go to the 24-hour DDO duty officer, who would call Jim Potts, discuss the text with him over the telephone, and send out an answer.